Yes, sir. Thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to this very nice meeting. As Paul just said, this is other waves. It is different from, but it is different from 2D waves, the 2D irritational waves we had most of yesterday. The waves this morning we've heard so far have had vorticity, and that differs them from the standard 2D water wave problem. These waves are three-dimensional but irritational. So we're diverging from 2D water waves again. So as I'm the first person to talk about 3D water waves, let me just outline the problem and the notation I'm going to use. This is a sketch of a three-dimensional fluid. We're bounded below by a rigid horizontal bottom and above by a free surface, so it's finite depth. The free surface is supposed to be a graph. The coordinates here are x across, y vertically upwards, and z is the third coordinate, which is pointing out of the screen. So the free surface is a graph which depends upon x and z and upon the time t. We're going to model the water as a perfect fluid, which means the mathematical problem is to solve Laplace's equation in the interior. On the rigid horizontal bottom, we've got the Neumann boundary condition. And the interesting stuff goes on at the free surface, where we've got these two nonlinear boundary conditions, which you've all seen before. The first is the kinematic boundary condition. This is the condition that defines the free surface, says no water gets across. The second is the dynamic boundary condition at the free surface. This is the condition of balance of force at the free surface. It says that the pressure here just inside the water balances the atmospheric pressure when you take gravity and surface tension into account. So here's the notation. G is the acceleration due to gravity. Sigma is the coefficient of surface tension. And one other parameter, this H, which is the depth of the water. Well, I mean, I always say this right away. I mean, but it's the wrong audience to tell this. There are obviously two difficulties in the water wave problem which make it hard. Firstly, you've got the free boundary value problem. You've got to find the function eta as part of the solution. And secondly, you've got the two nonlinear boundary conditions at the free surface. And it's sort of interesting that the whole of the nonlinearity in this problem is at the free surface. Well, then, the title of my talk involves solitary waves, so I just want to tell you what a solitary wave is now. And let me start by telling you what a traveling wave is. For me, a traveling wave is any wave which moves with constant speed c in the x direction without change of shape. So that means the function theta and phi will depend upon x and t only through the combination x minus ct. And they'll depend upon the transverse direction z in some other way, which will come out in the wash of what we're doing. Okay then, now, a solitary wave then, again, for me, a solitary wave is going to be any wave with the property that decays to zero far up and downstream in the direction it's traveling, yeah? So there's no prescription at all about what happens in the transverse direction. If your wave decays to zero far up and downstream in the direction you're traveling, it qualifies as a solitary wave. Just want to say this now before I forget. When you make the ansatz for solitary waves or traveling waves into this, obviously you get a slightly simplified problem because the t here changes to c d by dx. You can key it up by non-dimensionalizing. You find the problem depends upon these two parameters, which I've called alpha and beta. You don't have to remember what these parameters are, but alpha for me sort of measures the speed of the wave and beta measures the strength of surface tension. So this is a more applied audience. So for you, alpha is 1 over the square of the Froude number. And beta is this thing usually called the Weber number. It's the Bond number divided by the square of the Froude number. Just use this combination because it appears slightly more cleanly in the equations. And I'll always say x as an abbreviation for x minus ct from this point onwards. Okay, so time is now completely out of it. Okay then, well, as I said, a solitary wave is anything which decays to zero far up and downstream, and there are several possibilities. So here they are. That well focused? No, it's worse now. That's okay. So there are three sort of basic possibilities for solitary waves, in my opinion, and here they are. I call this a line solitary wave, this one a periodically modulated solitary wave, and this one is a fully localized solitary wave. Now let me just explain what's going on here. These waves are obviously all moving in the x direction with constant speed. They all have a pulse-like profile in the x direction. In fact, the first two you can see are waves of depression. I guess this is as well, the central trough. And they all do different things in the z direction. The first one doesn't do anything at all in the z direction. It's just constant in the z direction. So it's a line solitary wave. You know, it's really just a 2D solitary wave. The second one is actually periodic in the z direction. So you've got this periodic modulation superimposed upon the pulse-like profile in the x direction. So this is a periodically modulated solitary wave. Again, my notation, and I take full responsibility for it. This is the fully localized solitary wave, decays to zero in all directions. Now, where did I pluck these particular examples from? The answer is they all exist as explicit solutions to the KP1 equation, which is supposed to model water waves in a regime where alpha is close to 1 and beta is bigger than 1/3. So strong surface tension. It's important now that beta is bigger than 1/3. So those all exist as solutions to the KP1 model equation. We all think that the KP1 model equation is rather good. So if it is so good, we should be able to find these as solutions to the Euler equations over there. And we can. And in this talk, I just want to give you a little flavor of the existence proofs of each of these types of waves as solutions of the Euler equations over there. Okay. Now, we've heard a bit about variational principles, and there was a question about Luke's variational principle just at the end of the last talk. So that brings me on nicely to this. The key to it all, in fact, is Luke's variational principle. So here's Luke's variational principle written down for steady waves in non-dimensional coordinates. It's very easy to see that you recover the equations written down over there from this variational principle. Take the variations with respect to phi, and you get Laplace's equation, the phi y equals 0 at the bottom, and the kinematic boundary condition at the free surface. Take the variation with respect to eta, you'll get the dynamic condition at the free surface. Okay, but even at a formal level, this is very unpleasant. The problem is that phi, one of the variables phi, depends upon the other variable eta. You see, phi is the velocity potential defined in the fluid domain. The fluid domain depends upon the free surface, which is given through eta. So we need to get rid of that somehow. Now, one very cheap trick, which turns out to be a good trick, is this. Just introduce a new vertical coordinate, y tilde, just by scaling by the depth, you see? The old y lies in the interval 0 to 1 plus eta. So if you scale it by 1 plus eta, you get something lies in the interval 0 to 1. Then introduce a new velocity potential capital phi just by making this change of coordinates in the old velocity potential. Plug this in, and out pops a new variational principle. The advantage is it's now in a fixed domain, because instead of the variable domain for phi, capital phi is defined in a strip, going from y equals 0, y tilde equals 0, and y tilde equals 1. So now we've got a new variational principle. You can work it out explicitly. I haven't done so here, but I will write down this formula a bit later. Now, once you've got this new variational principle, what are you going to do with it? Well, I would say there are two obvious things you could do with the variational principle. Firstly, you could try to find critical points of it, right? Because critical points of a variational principle should be solutions of the problem you're looking for. So you could try to apply the direct methods of the calculus of variations to the variational principle to find solutions. And this is the key to finding the fully localized solitary wave, in fact. There's another thing you can do with it, however, which is also touched upon this morning. You could think about your variational principle as an action functional. Now, what's an action functional? Well, it's really something you do with undergraduate calculus, right? It means Hamilton's principle of least action. I give you an action functional, some function which depends upon coordinates called q's and velocities called q dots. And once you've got that, then you can do the Legendre transformation and find a formulation of whatever problem you're looking at as a Hamiltonian system. Then you try to find solutions of the Hamiltonian system. Well, we could do that here. Now you say, well, we've got a problem now, though, because there's no time in your formulation. You've gone to a moving frame of reference. So how to get around that? Well, my answer to that is, what's so special about time? Time is just a variable which is unbounded in forward and backward directions, and you have two of those around. The horizontal directions in this picture, x and z, are both unbounded spatial directions. So you could choose those to be your time-like coordinate and view the variational principle here as an action functional with either x or z as time. So you see here I've chosen x to be time, so this is again schematic. You see eta and phi are the coordinates, eta x and phi x are the velocities. Over here I've chosen z to be the time, so I've got eta and phi again as the coordinates and eta z phi z as the velocities. Do the Legendre transform, and in each case you'll get a Hamiltonian system with either x as time or z as time. Now again, I want to say here that this is a very simple thing to do, this Legendre transform. You can do it explicitly, and you can write down the Hamiltonian system that you get explicitly as well. It's a simple calculation, but this explicit formula actually takes a whole page to write down in each case, so I haven't done it here. So I'm just leaving everything in this symbolic notation. This is the key to the line solitary wave. This is the key to the periodically modulated solitary wave, so it turns out. Now, I just want to take the remaining time just to give you a little flavor of each of these three processes. Taking this as x as time and finding the line solitary wave, taking z as time finding the periodically modulated solitary wave, and applying the direct method of the calculus of variations to find the fully localized solitary wave. Excuse me, say again?
So you're speaking about solitary waves.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't used any specific...
Not yet, no. No, I haven't. I haven't.
Okay.
So here's the first type of wave. Here's the line solitary wave. A pulse-like profile in X doesn't depend upon Z. Okay? Sorry, yes? Well, why is bounded? So it doesn't qualify as time-like. Well, my definition of an evolutionary equation is that the time-like variable should be unbounded. Just accept this as my definition of an evolutionary equation, ut equals f of u, where t is an unbounded coordinate. So y, the depth of the water, doesn't qualify because it's bounded. So, if you like. Yes, it's just the scale depth. The original depth is just 0 to 1 plus eta, so y tilde lies in the interval 0 to 1. Yes? Of course. But it's perfectly valid, it's just a change of variable. No, of course not. You get instead of the Laplace equation, you'll import the nonlinearity from the free surface in the interior. You get a quasi-linear elliptic equation. A bit like the one which Walter Strauss showed us. Okay. So here we are. I want to talk about line solitary waves. Take the formulation over here in which x is now, you do the Gendre transform from the action functional and get a Hamiltonian system with x as time. I call this method, by the way, spatial dynamics because it's actually a spatial variable playing the role of time. Now, this shouldn't frighten you at all because this is what you do when you take the KdV equation and show it to undergrads. You say, go x minus ct and then plot the phase space of the resulting dynamical system. And when you find a homoclinic solution in the phase space, that's the solitary wave you're after. A homoclinic solution being a solution which connects the origin with itself. So that's all I want to do here. If I can find a homoclinic solution to this, this will be a solution which connects 0 to 0 via a pulse, which is exactly what we're looking for here. Okay, and it's actually almost as simple, well, if you forget all the technical details, the idea is almost the same as in KdV. So here you are. If I give you an evolution equation and say, okay, go away and analyze this, what's the first thing you do? The answer is you calculate the spectrum of the linear operator. It's always what you do. And in this particular case, you get the following picture. So again, in this parameter regime, beta is bigger than a third, strong surface tension, alpha close to 1, so a little bit bigger than 1. You get two eigenvalues close to the origin like this, two real eigenvalues, order epsilon, and the rest of the spectrum is bounded away from the imaginary axis in two wedge-like regions. Now this is kind of a classical situation for invariant manifold theory. There's a theorem available, which I've called here the Kirch-Gessner reduction, which tells you, actually, there's a two-dimensional invariant manifold for your problem, the flow upon which is controlled by these two eigenvalues. So you go away and do some calculations and calculate the flow on this invariant manifold, and here it is. This is the answer. You get a higher order leading term plus, you get this leading term plus higher order parts. When you scale them, these higher order parts are order epsilon. If you forget these order epsilon terms, it's very easy to draw the phase portrait. Look, here it is. It's the fish. Get this fish-like picture. And you can see the homoclinic orbit connecting the origin with itself. Okay? Well, that homoclinic orbit is exactly what you're looking for. This is the solitary wave we were trying to find. And it's a very easy exercise now to show that when you bring back the order epsilon Hamiltonian perturbation, that this phase portrait doesn't change qualitatively. So there you are. You can find the line solitary wave by basically doing a bit of dynamical systems type analysis. Okay. Now let me come to the periodically modulated solitary wave now. So now I want to do spatial dynamics again, but this time Z is the time-like direction Z is the transverse direction. Okay, so now what kind of solution are we looking for? The answer is we need a periodic solution, yeah? The periodically modulated solitary waves are periodic in the z direction. So we're no longer looking for a homokinetic solution, we're looking for a periodic solution of this equation. Now, how would that work? Okay, again, if you know a little bit about finite dimensional Hamiltonian systems, it's not so difficult, and if you don't, I'll now tell you what it is you need to know. First of all, we need to fix things up properly. I realize you have to move things to the in the opposite direction you think. Okay, so here we are. Here's the spatial dynamics formulation, again with z as time. I need to fix up the function space properly. Yeah? I want everything to have a pulse-like profile in x. So let's fix up the function space to be a function space whose elements are pulse-like profiles. In other words, all the functions in the phase space are functions which decay as x goes to plus or minus infinity, which means that every solution has no choice but to have a pulse-like profile in the x direction because it's living in a function space of things which have pulse-like profiles in the x direction. Now, here's the key observation. An equilibrium solution of this must give you a line solitary wave. Now, let's explain that. What's an equilibrium solution? A solution which doesn't depend upon time, but the time is z, the transverse direction to the wave. So an equilibrium solution is a solution which doesn't vary in the z direction, but it automatically has a pulse-like profile in the x direction because all the functions in the function space do. So an equilibrium solution of that is actually a line solitary wave, a pulse-like profile in x, no variation in z. Now, from the last part, we already have a nice line solitary wave, which gives us an equilibrium, which I've called here U line solitary wave. I don't know why I've got the star as well. It's double notation. So what we're going to do is just change the coordinates to bring the line solitary wave, which is an equilibrium, to the new origin. This is exactly what you do in dynamical systems as well, right? I give you an equilibrium, you linearize around it. So let's do that. When we change the coordinates like this, we get a slightly new equation, which, of course, is a bit messy. So again, I just write it down here in abstract form. And now you have the same drill. I say to you, okay, here's an evolutionary equation. Go away and analyze it. You say, okay, fine, I'm going to calculate the spectrum. And this time you get the following picture, completely different to the previous one. You get two purely imaginary eigenvalues this time, order epsilon again, and you get continuous spectrum along the whole of the real axis. Okay, now, for those of you who know a bit about Hamiltonian systems, that continuous spectrum looks a disaster, but let's just forget it. Let's just ignore it. Let's just suppose it wasn't there. What would you do if I said to you, here's a Hamiltonian system with two purely imaginary eigenvalues? You'd say, aha, Lyapunov center theorem. Hamiltonian system, pair of purely imaginary eigenvalues, has periodic solutions, and their frequencies are close to the magnitudes of the purely imaginary eigenvalues. Well, if that would work here, that would be great, you see, because a periodic solution of this guy, the spatial dynamics with z as time, is exactly what you're looking for. It's a periodically modulated solitary wave. Periodic means periodic with respect to z, but everything has a pulse-like profile with respect to x. So a periodic solution of this evolutionary equation gives you a periodically modulated solitary wave. Okay. So if we didn't have this continuous spectrum, we'd be in business. But we do have it. But there are infinite dimensional versions of the Lyapunov center theorem due to essentially Devaney and Nuss, which help us out here. Devaney showed that the fact that it's finite dimensional doesn't matter. It works for infinite dimensional cases as well. But you need a non-resonance condition, which is that no further spectral point is an integer multiple of this pair of purely imaginary eigenvalues. Now here you're dead already, look, because the origin's in the spectrum and it's a multiple of, however you look at it, zero is a multiple of anything. So you're dead because of that. But Jost basically showed that actually, if you look at the details of the proof, it doesn't really matter that zero is in the spectrum. You just need to be able to solve a certain equation. And the condition essentially is that the range of the nonlinear part should lie in the range of the linear part, possibly by manipulating the function spaces to make it so. Now, this is a condition which you can check, and it is satisfied for our equation, and so there you are. We can apply the infinite dimensional version of the Lyapunov center theorem and get periodic solutions of the evolutionary equation, which give us the periodically modulated solitary waves. Okay, so now I come to the last part, the fully localized solitary wave. So there it is. This in some ways is the most interesting of the lot, and the way to find it is actually to apply the direct method of the calculus of variations to the action functional we had at the beginning, the one you get directly from Luke's principle by doing a flattening transformation. And this is rather unpleasant. So I just want to give you a little bit of a flavor of the details, no more than that, and certainly none of the technical parts. But if I can at least persuade you of what the most difficult part is, then I will be, and how we have some hope of overcoming it, then I'll be happy. Look, here is the variational principle, which comes from down here. Alas, there's a change of notation. Rho is the same thing as eta. I'm very sorry. Rho is the same thing as eta. Okay. So I promised you could write it down explicitly. Well, there it is written down explicitly. It's the one you get by doing the flattening transformation to Luke's variational principle. Now then, let's stare at that for a moment, this variational principle. There are many sort of standard methods available in the literature now for the direct methods of the calculus of variations. So it's a sort of become a whole industry. But most of the standard methods rely upon one thing. The variational principle you're looking at should be semi-linear. Now, what does that mean? That means that the highest order derivative should appear only in the quadratic part of the functional. Now, let's have a look at that guy. So the highest order derivative is obviously 1, right? First order derivatives only. So there you go, on the quadratic part, you've got phi x squared. But look, let's take a higher order part. Let's take a cubic term. In there, you've got phi y squared e to z squared. So in a fourth order term, you've also got first derivatives. So you haven't got the semilinear structure. This is quasi-linear. So you're kind of messed up because of that. Now, the way to get around this is to rewrite your problem, do a sort of reduction, which converts the quasi-linear variational principle into a locally equivalent semi-linear one, and then you can apply the standard methods to that. Now, I'm not sure. I'll say a little bit about how it works, but yes. Although I do note that I was interrupted by several questions, but not sure how. Okay. Let me just say a little bit about it then, and I probably won't get to the end, but that's not so tragic. What you do is you write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for this. So, I mean, it's an easy thing to do. Here's the Euler-Lagrange equation for eta. Here's the one for capital phi. So here I've just written down the linear parts explicitly, and the quadratic parts are just written as f's. The nonlinear parts are just written as f's. First thing to note, in the Euler-Lagrange equation for eta, you can solve eta as a function of phi. And when I say eta as a function of phi, this is a functional dependence involving the first derivatives as well. Okay? Well, first and second derivatives, in fact. Okay? So you invert this equation, find eta as a function of phi, and plug it back into the variational principle. Because it comes from a variational principle, when you plug this eta as a function of phi back into the variational principle, you get a new variational principle, which corresponds to the Euler-Lagrange equations here by plugging eta of phi into here. You can always do this because the two equations come from a variational principle. So now you have a variational principle for phi alone, you've got rid of eta. That's the first thing to do. Now what you do is you rewrite the Euler-Lagrange equation for phi as an integral equation. So here's the integral equation I'm talking about. You do it by taking the Fourier transform with respect to x and z and using a Green's function to write the corresponding thing as an integral equation. And then you stare at the Green's function. It turns out, I won't go through the details, they're on the next transparency, I'll skip that. The Green's function turns out to have a leading order part plus a higher order part. You split the Green's function into two parts and split the phi into two parts according to the decomposition of the Green's function into two parts. The higher order part can be solved as a function of the lower order part. And by inverting the higher order part into the equation for the lower order part, you get one reduced equation again. So it's a bit like the Lyapunov-Schmidt reduction, you know? You know how to do the Lyapunov-Schmidt reduction? It turns, for instance, a PDE into an ODE. So it's the same sort of thing, but we use it here to turn a quasi-linear PDE into a semi-linear PDE. Now, the variational Lyapunov-Schmidt method also reduces the variational principle, not just the equation. It reduces a variational PDE into a variational ODE. And here you do the same thing. It reduces a variational quasi-linear PDE into a variational semi-linear PDE in the same sort of way. The key is the splitting of the Green's function into two parts. It's almost exactly the same as in the Lyapunov-Schmidt reduction. The details are rather difficult, but when you go through it, when you go through this, write down the reduced variational principle and do a quick derivative count, you find you've won. And lo and behold, the leading order part of G is actually the linear operator associated with the KP equation, which is the motivation at the very beginning anyway. So it kind of sits together very nicely like that. It's got a little sting in the tail because there are nonlinear operators in here. And if you've ever tried to do calculus of variations on unbounded domains when you've got non-local operators, that's also not quite so easy. So there's a little sting in the tail as well. But the meat of this is in the reduction from quasi-linear to semi-linear. Okay, so I've gone a little bit over. Thanks very much.